News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ, whether you're on the AM side of your dial at News Talk 580, maybe on the FM side at 105.9, or online anytime, anywhere around the world at kmjnow.com. You know that each week we spend an hour visiting with veterans, mostly from the World War II era. We want to know what they did back then to secure our freedom. We don't take that freedom for granted, and we want to honor them for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten. And along the way, be educated and inspired by how much these guys love their country. I know that's the case today for B.A. Hansen, who also loves Castle Air Museum, and that's where we're recording this interview. If you have not been to Castle Air Museum in Atwater, what are you waiting for? They only have more than 50 planes out here with all kinds of history behind them, and we're going to get the history of some of those planes from a guy who flew some of them. B.A. Hansen's going to be 90 years old in July. Oh, sorry, that's not the way you want to put it. 45 again, right?
Yes, that's right.
And 1945 was an eventful year for you. We're going to get to that. But let's go back before that. You had moved from your boyhood home in Longmont, Colorado, to Long Beach in Southern California. And I guess when you were a senior at Wilson High down there in Long Beach, you started working at Douglas Aircraft. Did you have a dream of becoming a pilot already?
Not yet, until I was at Douglas for a little while. And then I wanted to become a pilot.
And what kind of work were you doing there at the aircraft factory?
I was in the machine shop working, and then I became a lead man. And we had a lot of women starting to work at the, because men are being called to the military. I stayed for a little while and wanted to be a pilot, because I had had a lot of time working on airplanes, etc., even in high school. In high school, I attended a machine, not a machine shop course, but a aviation shop, probably the only one in the country. And that's where I really became interested in becoming a pilot also.
And I know you've never lost that love for aviation. That much is clear. I want to ask you, it would have been during that senior year of high school there, a few months into that senior year, when December 7th, 1941 rolled around and the world changed a little bit. I've had a lot of guys who were in high school at the time tell me that their high schools called everyone into the gym or the auditorium or something like that on the day after when President Roosevelt gave his speech and made everyone listen to that radio broadcast. Was that the case for you guys there in Long Beach?
That's true. That's how we learned all about it. And knowing that we were involved, that we then had to prepare to really go into war.
And you had this idea that being a pilot would be a fun adventure for you. How hard was it to become a pilot? Because I know I've talked to a lot of guys who signed up for the Army Air Corps and thought they would be pilots, but they ended up as gunners or navigators or bombardiers because they washed out of the pilot training at some point. Was that difficult for you to pass all those tests and get your wings?
No, it wasn't, because that's what I wanted to do.
When you think back of all the things you had to do to prepare to fly and to pass all the checks and all the tests, was there one part of that that maybe gave you the biggest challenge that felt really satisfying when you cleared that hurdle?
No, I was involved with aircraft in high school, and then I also wanted to be working for Douglas Aircraft. I did that, and then when the war broke out, I was stayed at Douglas for a little while and decided I wanted to be a pilot. Went up to L.A., took the cadet exam. A month later, I was in the service.
That was 1943, so you didn't wait around to be drafted. You just wanted to get in yourself, huh?
Yes, that's correct. I really wouldn't have been drafted because I was working at Douglas Aircraft.
You would have had that work exemption, and you could have stayed at the aircraft factory throughout the war and not put yourself in danger. What was it that made you so determined to get in and do what you did?
I wanted to be a pilot.
Do you remember what it felt like the first time you got up in the air and got your first taste of that bird's eye view?
It felt great.
What kind of plane was it?
PT-13 biplane. in primary, and it was at Lancaster, California.
And something tells me if you went to an air show and you saw one of those planes tomorrow, you would hop in the cockpit and see what you could do with it, if they let you.
I would be glad to.
There was no doubt in my mind. I could see the look in your eye. That's not what you would fly once you got your wings, though. Did you have an idea? I've talked to a lot of guys, whether they ended up being bomber pilots or fighter pilots, they had a particular plane that they thought, you know, that would be a great plane to fly. When you were going through all this training in 1943 and 1944, was there a plane out there that you said, you know what, that's the one I want to be in the cockpit of?
The 51. I really enjoyed it. The 51, the P-51 is my favorite airplane. So when I got into 51s, I felt great.
So if a P-47 pilot were here, what would you say to him?
Sorry.
You know, there seems to be this rivalry, whether I talk to a Jug pilot or a Mustang pilot. They all have something to say about the other guy's plane. Well, I asked you about, you know, your first flight. What about that first time you got in the P-51? What did that feel like? Had you ever been in something with that kind of power behind it?
No, that was the first one.
For most of us, I think most of the people in our audience, most of the people in the world, have never had that experience of flying a P-51, which at this time was superior in so many ways to the other planes that America had been flying with, for the speed that it had and the maneuverability. What was it about that plane that you liked so much?
Well, the maneuverability was great, but I did so many other things with the airplane. Dropped bombs, skipped bomb. I did aerial gunnery, ground gunnery, and it's just a great airplane to do whatever you want.
Were you itching to get overseas and fly that plane in a serious combat situation?
Yes, due to the fact we knew that we were flying it, that we should do our fair share and do what we could to get there.
You got to England when? In the spring of 1945?
Yes. It was early 45, and I was only over there for a short time. I only had a few missions escorting B-24s and B-17s. I wasn't there long enough to do a whole lot, but I was there. I would like to have done much more, but fortunately we were able to finish the war, and I came home and became an instructor then.
I've talked to so many bomber pilots, many of whom flew missions with or without escort fighters, and they've expressed how thankful they were for the missions where they had fighter escort, like you provided with those P-51s. Can you give us a sense of what it's like to be in that role, to be in that cockpit, flying on the outside of this formation of bombers? And to me, it seems like you've really got to be alert and constantly on edge, looking for the enemy to pop up somewhere. What can you walk us through a mission like that and give us an example of what that experience was like?
We basically, as you mentioned, flew alongside of the bombers. And fortunately, we didn't have a lot of the German aircraft coming up because it was right toward the end of the war. Our basic job was just escorting to keep the other fighters away. That was basically it, and we did have to be very alert, make sure we kept our eyes on the area around us, and it was no big problem.
This was late enough in the war that you really didn't encounter much in terms of enemy fighter planes. Were there any that you saw coming toward your formation that you had to scare off or fend off somehow?
I think the ones that did see us didn't want to come up because they knew they were going to get attacked as well. So they didn't, for some reason, come up to us. They were busy mostly down low trying to do work with the Army on the ground.
Well, and the other thing that comes to mind for me when you talk about being there for the last few months of the war in Europe and flying the P-51, and I mentioned how fast that plane was, and it was superior velocity-wise to anything that had been flying to that point. But then this is about the time that the Germans found a trump card for that and a plane even faster than the P-51. Did you ever see any of those ME-262s or other German jets flying by?
Not the 262s. Mostly the 109s, but we didn't have any big problems with them. If they saw there was more 51s up around the bombers, they didn't seem to want to come up.
I imagine word spreads pretty fast when you're out there with other pilots. Did you guys catch wind of this development that the Germans had jet fighters now and were starting to deploy them?
Yes, we had heard about it. Fortunately, we didn't have to fly against them, so they were pretty much interested in the other Berlin area and also around the northern part of Germany. They were interested in getting over to England also with those jets, so we didn't have any big problem where I was.
Well, I guess what I'm curious about is getting inside your head at the time. And did you know that you had nothing to worry about, or was there some concern, hey, there's something out there that's even faster than we are that, you know, if I'm up there against this guy, I'm in trouble?
Yes, we knew we could be in trouble. Fortunately, they didn't come our direction too much.
You know, now jets are so commonplace. I mean, we fly on them all the time, everywhere we go, and it's hard to think of a time when no one knew about jet aircraft, but that was the case back then. So I wonder, as someone who had worked in an aircraft factory, who had been flying the fastest plane that America had at the time, was it a little mind-blowing or world-changing to try to wrap your brain around jet technology and the idea that there could be something faster out there?
Yes, we gave it some thought. It make us very interested to get to the opportunity to fly the jets. But at that time, during World War II, we didn't have that opportunity, so we didn't get involved in that.
You would have that opportunity, plenty of opportunity to spend time in jet aircraft. But I want to hear from you about the end of World War II, because you went over there in early 1945. The war in Europe ends in May of 1945. Do you remember how you found out about that, that the war in Europe was over, and what that meant to you?
It happened so quick that I guess we didn't give it much thought while we were there. We were glad it was over. We were really interested in getting back to the States.
Well, and you were a new kid on the block over there. You probably didn't have as much points as some of the other guys. Were you concerned that you might be sent to the Pacific to fly over there?
Yes, we knew that could happen, but it didn't happen to me, so I wasn't worried about it.
And what did happen to you is you came back to the States and you spent some time as a flight instructor at an air base. Tell me about that.
I was at Luke as an instructor on AT-6s, the advanced trainer. I did pretty good on that. I stayed there for probably a little over a year as an instructor and then went to other jobs.
But I guess it was a pretty big deal that you ended up there for that year, because if I understand it right, if you hadn't been assigned to Luke Air Base and serving as a flight instructor there, you wouldn't have met your wife? Do I have that right?
That's true. I wouldn't have met her. She was a civilian working on base, and she worked for supply. She worked down on the flight line ordering parts for the aircraft maintenance people. It wasn't long till I met her. I guess that was in late 45, and then in September 46, we got married.
September 46, so I guess about a year after you met her. Did you have to convince her a little bit that she should marry you? Was that an easy sell or a hard sell?
No, really, the way we met, I had finished my cadet class, and I was working on my car. I had a 40 Oldsmobile, and I was working on my car up near my quarters. She and her girlfriend came by. They were on their way to the BX to have lunch. Two of my friends were out watching me work on my car. When the girls came by, they whistled and hubba-hubbed. My wife said when she went home that night, she told her mother that she saw the man she was going to marry. I didn't do any hubba hubba and whistling, so I guess that's what she liked.
Sounds like one of the wisest moves you ever made. A little self-control goes a long way, huh?
Well, after that, the next day I was finishing up on my car. The girls came by again going to lunch, and I offered them a ride, and that's how we got started. I guess I really didn't have a chance after she said she saw the man she was going to marry. So I didn't have much of a chance after that.
And she never changed her mind.
She didn't change her mind. And now we've been married, well, let's see, in September will be 67 years.
And you have 5 daughters and 10 grandchildren and 8 great-grandchildren who wouldn't be here had you not been such a gentleman, I guess. So good work. That's a lesson to the rest of us out there to follow your example. So now you have a wife and you're starting a family, and the Air Force sends you to Germany?
Yes.
We'll hear about Germany and Korea and Vietnam when we come back. B.A. Hansen of Winton, California, our guest today. If you visit Castle Air Museum in Atwater to check out the more than 50 planes on display, he can tell you stories about flying in just about half of them, really. And we'll get more of his story when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming to you this week from one of Central California's best-kept secrets, Castle Air Museum in Atwater, on our website, kmjnow.com, the Hometown Heroes section, of course. I have a list of upcoming events at Castle. You'll also find some photos of our guest today, 89-year-old B.A. Hansen of Winton. He retired as a lieutenant colonel after 27 years in the Air Force. When we left off, we were in the period immediately following World War II, and you were sent to Germany. What were you doing over there?
I went to Landsberg, Germany. I was in charge of the Polish Guard. The Polish Guard took care of the ammunition. It was an ammunition depot. And also, I was the operations officer for the base. So I did all kinds of things. But when they made me the intelligence officer for the base, that's when I asked to go to an intelligence school, because I knew nothing about that. I went to the intelligence school at Oberammergau, Germany. It was an army intelligence school. They also taught us the German language. The reason they had us learn the German language was in case we ran onto prisoners of war that had come back from Russia, possibly we would get intelligence information by interrogating those people.
Yeah, because we're post-World War II now, and really, some would say that the beginning of the Cold War, even though Korea hadn't happened yet, there's this big concern about the communists in Russia and what are they planning. So any intelligence you could glean from people that were their prisoners was going to prove valuable, and that's what you were training for? Do I have that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And in addition to the intelligence work, you were part of a radar early warning squadron. What did that mean?
When I got back from the intelligence school, they sent me to the aircraft early warning squadron. That was at Birkenfeld, Germany. They also made me a radar controller, and we would control the fighters out of Germany, and in case we had aircraft that were unidentified, we would get the fighters up and have them check out those airplanes.
Was that something that happened fairly frequently. Did you experience some times like that?
Yes, quite often we'd get the airplane or get the fighters up and check aircraft that were unidentified. So because I was doing that, they decided that, being I was a pilot, that I could go check out an F-84s and find out what they were doing. So I did, and I like to fly them.
Can you put into words for us the difference, the contrast between that P-51 propeller-powered that you had been flying in World War II to this jet aircraft now, a few years later, the F-84? Did it feel a lot different, the speed of it?
Yes, it did, but really the 86 was a much better airplane than the 84.
And you spent some time flying those and F-106s also?
Yes, I did. I flew, where I flew the F-86 was that I got into the training business. I had a training detachment going from base to base, training on different airplanes. And my first one was on the F-86. That was in New Mexico. I stayed there for about a year, and then they wanted me to go into F-100s, and they sent me to the factory school on the F-100. And then I picked up a training detachment on F-100s and went to Germany and spent a lot of time and went different bases in Germany and different bases. Let's see, I went to France, three bases, and then also over in England to a base. So I was training people on the F-100 in all those different bases.
And by the time your 27 years in the Air Force were over, you'd even fly C-130s. I guess the better question is, what didn't you fly in the Air Force?
Well, before I went to the 130, really, I came back to the States from the 100 training. They were going to send me up into New England, and I was from California, so I thought, since my family was here in California, they didn't go with me overseas. I wanted to come back to the West, so they sent me to C-121s up at McClellan. And I was there for about a year, and then I came to Castle with training detachments. I came and I was training people on the F-102, the B-52, and the KC-135. At one time, I had probably the biggest school in the country. I had 69 instructors training people on the three airplanes, the 52, the 135, and the 102, and later the F-106. In a three-year period, we did 1 million student hours of training.
That's not just you. That's all the people working under you. But I imagine if you tried to count every pilot that you gave instruction to, I mean, we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of pilots that you helped learn what they had to do for the service, huh?
Yes. We did a lot of training on not only pilots, but also navigators and bombardiers, along with the maintenance people. So I had a big school.
I guess so. And it strikes me that there are probably quite a few people out there listening who probably trained under you at one point or another, as long as you were doing that. And as many people, especially here in the Merced and Atwater area, tend to stick around Castle once they got stationed here and decided to live here. That's something that you certainly did, and I want to talk about that more, but I want to go back to a couple things. First of all, I kind of jokingly said, what didn't you fly in the Air Force? But it really sounds like you flew, at least had to understand almost every airplane that was in the air. Was that fun for you to get a taste of all these different airplanes of different sizes and shapes and capabilities?
Yes, I really enjoyed it. And when it came to doing the good job, I felt that I did a good job. I don't regret the fact that I flew in a lot of different airplanes, went a lot of places, seen a lot of the world. I have been a lot of places.
You've been everywhere, man, as the great Johnny Cash song goes. A couple things I want to go back to. One, when you talked about being in Germany and working with this radar interceptor squadron, and I talked a little bit about the climate at the time, I suppose, worldwide, and the tension that was brewing between America and the Soviet Republic. How tense was that for you? I mean, did you feel pressure that something could be happening at any time? Because a lot of people kind of forget about that. It's such, you know, it's so out of sight, out of mind for us now. But what was it like to be in that position at the time? Did you feel a tension, a responsibility, a pressure to what you were doing?
Yes, we knew that we could be called upon to be in the, be close enough to any war. Being pilots, we would be possibly going at any time.
And, you know, there aren't too many people that can make the claim that they flew in World War II, during the Korean War, and during the Vietnam War. But you're one of those people. What was it you were doing during the Korean War? You were back in P-51s?
Yes, P-51s. I wasn't there that long either, being the war was just about finished when I went over, so I didn't really get involved in too much. I did do a number of missions on working with the Army during flying against ground troops.
So you were bombing, strafing, stuff like that?
Yes, bombing, strafing, skip bombing, and dive bombing, and things of that nature.
And I think aviation junkies are familiar with the term skip bombing, but your average layperson out there, our average listener, might not understand what that means to skip bomb a target. Can you explain that to us, and what's the trick to doing it right?
Well, the trick is you come in low, at very low altitude, usually 15 to 20, maybe 30 feet off the ground, and you come in toward the target, and when you're just prior to the target, you make a pull up just after you drop the bomb, so you get away from the bomb as it explodes. You pull on up, usually make a complete turnover at the top, and you're flying away from the bomb.
So you pull up so sharply that you end up inverted and then have to turn out of that?
Yes. Just roll out, and you're going the opposite direction.
And I think, now you did it a few times, so it doesn't sound like a big deal to you. But to the rest of us, it sounds like you have a death wish there. I mean, there's a lot that can go wrong in that, right? Did you encounter enemy fire from the ground ever on missions like that?
Very little, in that I never did get hit in one time. But we'd come in low, drop the bomb, and as it was flying toward the target, we'd pull up and fly away from it, so we didn't have any problem.
So you're 30 feet off the ground or lower, which means if there were enemy guns on the ground there, they'd have a pretty good shot at you. And then you're dropping a bomb, which if you don't get out of there fast enough, can blow you to bits too. Were there ever some times where you felt that explosion a little more than you wanted to?
No, I never got that close.
You must have been a good pilot.
Well, I knew that when I dropped the bomb, I had to get away, or to get up and get away from it. So I'd pull up and make a roll over and go the opposite direction.
When that fighting halted in Korea, and they kept the parallel there, and they divided Korea to North and South, and it remains the same today, and there's some tension flaring up there again today. But at the time, was that frustrating to you, that you guys were going home? Was that a relief to you? How did you feel about the end of fighting there?
Well, we were definitely happy that the war had ended. We were really waiting to get home, so we didn't...
You didn't feel a sense of unfinished business at all?
No, we felt we had done our job, and we're ready to come on home.
And it's been more than 60 years now since the Korean War, and it's often called the Forgotten War. What do you think people should remember about what America did over there? Was it important? Is it something that's worth remembering today? And what are you proud of in terms of being a Korean War veteran?
Well, the fact that I did my share of trying to have an end become the end of the war, it did happen, so I was happy about that. In fact, it's still a good thing that there's a separation between North and South Korea. And I don't regret the fact that it's ended, and hopefully it won't start again.
Amen to that. All right. Well, we've talked about what you did in World War II. We've talked a little bit about what you did in Korea. Sure doesn't sound like it was as big a deal to you as I think the rest of us would expect it to be. Makes me wonder if you ever had any instances that you would consider a close call or something that came a little too close for comfort for you in all your 27 years in the Air Force.
Flying a P-51, I had a problem. We had been down to Texas from California, and we went down to Texas, and they were having a setup as if it was a real war down there, just an exercise. And when we left, I took off, and my engine started popping. And I thought I got up about 300 feet. I got about 300 feet, and it started popping and acting like it was going to quit. And I started looking for a place I was going to belly the aircraft in. Then I thought, well, I've got to see what I can do to make this thing go better. But I did feel that I was going to have to set it down somewhere in an open area, find a pasture somewhere or something of that nature. I got down to about 200 feet, and I started thinking, I think maybe I can try to clear out what the problem is in my engine. So I reached down and I hit the primer button to get more fuel into the engine. The primer runs fuel not through the carburetor, but through the right end of the engine, so right into the cylinders. So I did that. The engine started running better. I flew up around the pattern and landed and refueled and gave my man that worked on the airplane, give him heck for not clearing out the moisture out of the engine or out of the tank.
So many details that go into a successful flight, as every pilot knows. And that, yeah, I can't imagine being in that situation and wondering what was going to happen. And while we're on the topic of the P-51, and we mentioned how many different airplanes you flew in a 27-year Air Force career, but you've been very clear that the P-51 Mustang was your favorite. It wasn't the fastest one you flew. It wasn't the biggest one you flew. Was it because it sounded the best, that the sound of that engine is just a sweeter sound than anything else?
Well, it's that, but it's the fact that I did so many different things with it. As I get into jets, I didn't do a lot of those type of things. Do the ground gunnery and aerial gunnery and dive bombing, skip bombing, everything with it that I didn't do in flying jets. So that's what made me like the 51 so much better.
I know it's not too often that you get to see or hear a P-51 these days, but if you are somewhere and you see one going by, or you just are walking and you hear that familiar sound of that engine, what does that do to you? What does it bring up inside of you?
It brings back many memories of flying the airplane, and when you see one and hear it, you know it's a 51. You don't even have to see it. When you hear it, you know it's a 51.
Even if there's 6 other, 7 other, 10 other airplanes in the sky, you can tune that out, can't you?
That's right. I can tell which one is the, when I look, then I know which one is the 51. And I can tell from hearing it is a 51. But there's other aircraft that I can tell. The C-130, I can tell. It's just so many different airplanes you can tell what they are by their sound.
Well, you spent enough time with all of them to have that keen ear for it. We still have a little time left at Hometown Heroes, and we'll have more from 89-year-old B.A. Hansen. We've heard about World War II and Korea, but he also had a very interesting assignment during the Vietnam War. And we'll get that story when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ. Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Los Banos at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Los Banos every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Los Banos.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with B.A. Hansen of Winton, California. He and his wife, Jerry, will celebrate their 67th anniversary this year. I imagine she's heard some or all of the stories that we're hearing today. Mr. Hansen flew P-51 Mustangs during World War II and the Korean War. He also is a Vietnam veteran. What were you up to during that time period?
The Vietnam War, I was flying C-130s. I was stationed in Japan, but a month at a time, we'd go down and be in the Vietnam area. We'd fly at 38,000 feet, stay up there for 10 hours at a time. We had, in the back end of our C-130, we had a group of people recording all frequencies that they could get over the airwaves. When we finished, then we'd land and give the information to the intelligence people. The reason I was selected to go into 130s is because I had been an intelligence officer and had a top secret clearance. That's how I was selected to be a pilot in C-130s.
So you guys are up there flying around and they're collecting all this data that would then be passed down and used to decide where troops would go and when to attack a certain spot or things like that. Am I getting the gist of it?
Yes, that's correct. We would stay up there for a long period of time, record all the airwave noise, and we'd get information on what was happening in North Vietnam. And we would stay up there quite a while, and then after we would land, we would give the information to the intelligence people. They would take a look at it, and maybe they could use something for giving the information to the ground people.
And I'm guessing there was never too much concern about enemy fighters coming up to meet you that high?
Yes, there was, but we knew they were coming because we knew they were being directed our way. Our people in the back end knew they were coming. So knowing that they were coming to get us, we would turn toward the ocean, and the enemy fighters didn't want to come out over the ocean. We would fly on the red line, dive on the red line to get out over the ocean and get out far enough where the fighters didn't want to come after us.
And why wouldn't they want to go that far? It was too dangerous for them?
They didn't want to go out over the water. I don't know why, but we didn't have any problem. Once we got out about 75 to 100 miles, we didn't have any problem.
Again, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and I'm hearing what you're saying here. So you're flying a C-130, which is not going to outrace too much that's in the sky, and is not going to be able to escape much of these fighters that are coming after it. I mean, you're a bit of a sitting duck if someone actually has a beat on you. And then you actually know from the radio traffic that they're heading your way. Does that put a little fear in you, a little concern?
Well, yes, because we wanted to make sure we got out far enough out over the water, out over the ocean, to keep them from coming after us.
And is there an added element of responsibility or burden there because there were so many others on your airplane? Because you're not the only skin that's on the line here.
Oh, that's right. But there again, we, knowing that nobody wants to get hit by a fighter or for an enemy fighter, and we didn't want that to happen. So they understood what we were doing, that we would try to get out of the way.
I know that in all your years in the Air Force, and certainly the years here at Castle Air Museum since you've been out of the service, you've probably talked to a lot of other pilots. How many guys can say like you can that they flew in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam? Have you met very many others who can claim that?
Not too many. Very few. I do know of individuals that were in maybe one or two, but not all three.
So how much pride does that give you that you were able to serve your country in all three of those?
Well, yeah, I'm very proud that I was able to do what I could during those three wars.
I don't want to exaggerate, but it seems to me that the impact you were able to have is a lot greater than just your service in those three wars because of all the other pilots that you trained. Do you feel that way, that you had an impact in helping these other pilots go and perform their jobs?
Yes, I knew that once they went through my school, they would go back and do their jobs right. Most of them liked flying the particular airplanes they were in. Most cadets going to different airplanes like the fighters best. I guess it's because they like the speed and the maneuverability. But there are some that prefer to go to the bombers and what have you. But when I was going through school, I definitely wanted to get into fighters because that's what I like to fly.
So, and people still get this confused. I know that Joe Pruzzo here deals with this. Castle Air Force Base was shut down during the Clinton administration, but Castle Air Museum is still here and is a great place to come and explore the history of aviation, especially as it relates to our military. What was it that first hooked you in to Castle Air Museum? And can you tell us how you've been involved here over the years, what kinds of things you've done, and why?
Well, I came here training people on the airplanes at Castle. After I left here, I went back to Japan to fly the 130s over there. When I came back here, I came back to this base because my family was living here, and we've stayed here, and being I was a Californian anyway, I liked it.
What is it about this museum that that makes you want to support it the way you have, and what makes this place special? Why is it worth supporting and keeping alive?
Because keep the airplanes in good order for people to come and look at. There's a lot of history and a lot of good information that people can come and look at. They've heard a lot of the war and what have you that we were in. They've known that different airplanes were doing different things in the different wars. We have those airplanes here at Castle. We have them, and so the people want to come here and see them. And we like to keep them in darn good shape. So Castle Museum has been a good thing, and I like to support it because I'm aviation-minded. I've always liked airplanes, so I want Castle Museum to do a good job and do a good thing that they're doing.
I just want to say on behalf of our listeners, thank you for serving our country all 27 years, and thank you for what you've done out here at the Castle Air Museum as well. Is there anything else that you think we ought to know?
No, I think we pretty well covered it. I'm glad that I'm in the area that I can help do what I can.
And I guess I also need to ask you before I let you go, if you're going to celebrate your 67th wedding anniversary in September, what's your secret?
I love my wife. And she's been a good wife and has done a good job raising my five daughters. As the information indicates, I didn't know how to get boys because I didn't know how to put the right order in. So I'm happy with my five daughters. They're great girls, so I'm happy. I would like to have had a boy or two or three
But not at the expense of your girls. And I'm 2 for 2 on girls myself, so I get it. Well, I welcome in now Joe Pruzzo, the executive director here at the Castle Air Museum in Atwater. And Joe, you've heard Mr. Hansen's stories, and he wasn't bragging on himself, but I bet there's a few things that you wouldn't mind bragging about him on.
Well, I've known Mr. Hansen for many years, ever since my initial association with the museum back, about 1987, and he was very impressive to me back then, and hearing his stories, some of his many stories that we've heard just now, I'm really impressed by. Some of the things that our veterans did, a lot of things our veterans did, basically don't get told, and I love programs like this. We here at the museum try to extol these stories. We try to put them on video or DVD for future generations. I mean, generations 50 years from now can hear these firsthand accounts. And it's really a little different than getting it in a book. You're getting a firsthand account from a person who was there and lived it. And of course, it all goes with our mission statement to preserve military aviation heritage for future generations. And thankfully to gentlemen like Mr. Hansen, the volunteers here, this museum, which a lot of people don't really realize, has evolved into the largest aviation museum between the Los Angeles area and the Portland, Oregon area. As a nonprofit, funding is always primary on our radar scope. If anyone is out there who would like to help endow the museum, you know, contribute any donations, we would deeply appreciate it, because it takes a lot to keep the facility going, to keep the aircraft exhibits up, and to keep the history alive. We have a lot of students that come through, especially this time of year, on field trips, getting them through, teaching them about these aircraft, this history, what this gentleman has just mentioned, doesn't get taught in schools anymore. And that history is lost. And you know, it really hits home when a young person will say, where's Pearl Harbor? Or, you know, even up late, you know, up into 20 years ago, they're really not even knowledgeable on Desert Storm. You know, we kind of have this history from 9/11 forward. And there's so much prehistory on that, going back 60, 70, 80 years, that really needs to be told. So I would encourage everyone to come see us. We are open every day. Any contributions anyone out there would like to send, please, you know, we appeal to your help. And we look forward to hopefully seeing you come to the museum soon.
Well, and one thing they always want to know is, when can I get in those airplanes? So when's your next open cockpit day, and what else do you have coming up that's out of the ordinary and exciting for people to come get a taste of?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. Our next open cockpit day is this Memorial Day weekend. It's May 26th. It's Sunday. It's from 9 to 5. We will have a new Vietnam-era airplane, Navy aircraft displayed, the Douglas RA-3 Sky Warrior, which was used extensively on photo reconnaissance missions over Vietnam, the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Some aircraft were lost. This will be the only one of its type in a museum of that series of aircraft. Of course, people can see the B-52. A lot of the aircraft, at least 30-plus of the aircraft, will be open for viewing. People can, you know, look in a cockpit, have someone there explain. You can't sit in them because they're artifacts, but you can look in them and see all the, you know, implements that Mr. Hansen was talking about, you know, throttles, you know, bomb release switches, all these things that really make it interesting. And the fact that we have individuals there, some in flight suits, who flew them to explain what these aircraft did, what this switch does, makes it all the more interesting.
It's always interesting at Castle Air Museum in Atwater. Joe Pruzzo, thank you. Thanks again to B.A. Hansen, our veteran today. You can find pictures at kmjnow.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're out of time for today's show. Hope you'll join us again next week when we hear from a B-17 pilot shot down and held prisoner by the Germans. I encountered him on a recent trip to Reno, and he's had quite an experience recently with a great organization called Honor Flight. I think we can get Honor Flight rolling right here in Central California, and we'll talk about it next Saturday. So join me then for more Hometown Heroes on KMJ.